Welcome, everyone, to Rock'em Nation Podcast. This is another brand new episode of the Cocktail Hour featuring Sam and Matt. In my glass right now is a bottle of Baker's 7-Year Single Barrel. Matt, what's in your glass?
I'm being lame and drinking some Four Roses.
There's
just standard.
Nothing wrong with Four Roses.
Oh, no, there's not. The Baker's 7-Year, I will admit I've only had one glass. It was fantastic. And that's one of those bottles I've picked up like off a shelf 3 or 4 times. And then remember, this is the coronavirus economy. We should all probably squirrel away money and have not purchased it. So
I've had this one since, I want to say November, and didn't open it until the coronavirus pandemic sort of entered into everything, and it's just like, you know what, like I need to start opening some of this stuff that I've had for a while.
Well, the Four Roses, like, we have an upstairs bar, and then like we have we call it the Bassett Bunker, but really it's like our like crash area in the basement, and we've got like a small like selection of bottles down here, so it's Four Roses is one of them that's in the basement. So I cracked it open just because it was like,
is that a yellow or small batch?
Just a traditional yellow, nothing fancy, just the standard one, which I would recommend anybody to get. I got it for $29 at Kroger, so it was a nice little pickup.
I am a big fan of all things Four Roses. I think actually our last pod, I was drinking the Small Batch Select.
You were,
which is their.
I was jealous of you.
They're kind of higher end. I think around town it's mid to upper 50s, which isn't too bad.
That's what it's going for here.
Yeah, and honestly, well worth it. The Baker's is really good. I like it a lot. It's got a nice little flavor profile, good notes of vanilla, a little leathery. I like it. If given a choice, Matt, I think I would go Four Roses Small Batch Select. I think they're pretty equal price points. I think the Small Batch Select might be a little better. But this is actually not the Cocktail Hour. I'm going to joke with that intro until we actually have live sports again. This is an episode of Dive Cuts. We are 25 episodes into season 3.
Who knows? Who knows where we are?
And
And
Mizzou basketball. All the things that are happening, not happening. Coaches are still recruiting.
Could potentially happen.
Apparently, Axel Okongo is getting dunked on Twitter by...
Literally and figuratively.
Yes. By a former Mizzou recruit, Terrence Hargrove Jr., who's a guy I think both you and I sort of kind of wish was on the Tigers roster. But ended up at SLU. Mizzou kind of stopped recruiting him. And he really wanted to be close to home. I think his mom, if I remember correctly, has
she has some health issues
and has trouble traveling. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
being at SLU is honestly a really good thing for him and his family. Family can get out to see him play a bunch, and he's still an exciting looking athlete.
While we are a Mizzou pod, we can both voice our appreciation for Yuri Collins and Terrence Hargrove. I think we both like those guys. Both think those are really good pickups, and we enjoyed watching them play hoop. I think they've got two really nice young players over there.
I will say, like, I do think that Yuri is probably a better fit for the A-10 than he would be for the SEC. SEC is a rough league, man. I think Hargrove is athletic enough that he would be fine there, but and big enough, but it is a physical league. I remember talking to, I think it was Jordan Geistad, who just said that each year, by the end of the year, Jordan was just like worn down by how, you know, physical and athletic the league is. It's just a rough league.
Yeah, the SEC's foul rates are usually one of the highest in the country. Usually, as one of the at least offensively, the tempo is pretty perky. So you're getting knocked around a little bit. There's some up and down aspects to it. It's not quite the Big Ten in terms of physicality and where refs will let you just kill each other, but it's stout, to say the least.
Yeah. So, since our last pod, it's been 2 weeks. actually shortly after I think we recorded, Anton Brookshire decided to commit to the Tigers. What was the timing on that? Do you remember?
It was about a week afterwards, but I think we had heard kind of rumblings. We heard rumblings that that might be in the pipeline a couple of days after we recorded, and then there were, obviously an offer had to be made. There had to be some discussions and stuff like that that have to happen before a guy officially pulls the trigger. But I think, yeah, that had been kind of in the works for about a week. And then they're going on about a week now since the commitment happened. So it was kind of in the pipeline. It was in process.
Yeah.
After we recorded.
Your thoughts on the commitment? I know you had some initial kind of things that you pecked out, you know, once the commitment happened. Anything you want to flesh out?
I think this is the one time a year where I wish, you know, obviously we wish we had a live period. You know, we all, you know, I think coaches, you know, wonks like us wish we had it. But especially for a guy like Brookshire, who has always measured out, or at least been reported to be about 6 foot 155. I'd heard that he had grown a couple of inches and that there might be another growth spur on the way. So for me, it was just to like see him live and on, you know, on the hoof and see kind of what he looks like physically would have been really great, because I think skill wise, you and I agree, there's a lot to like about him. I think he's a guy who, if you really go dig through his film and not like YouTube kind of highlight clips, but you go to his huddle and you watch, you know, a guy parked with a camera at midcourt and you watch, you know, boring, kind of just bland, what would be boring and bland tape, you know, a lot sticks out about him as a guy who can, you know, be crafty on the ball and, you know, a guy who I think is savvier than people realize working off the ball. I think that he's kind of got that flexibility to be a really good combo guard. And if he's 6'2 and still growing, you know, I think this is a really, really good pickup. I think he's got all the skills that you want in that position. And if you get a little bit more size and you give him, you know, over to Nicodemus Christopher and you get, you know, some good mass and some good strength on him, I really think this is a high, you know, a high ceiling pickup for them. So that's, I just want to start there. I think, you know, physically and, you know, just, you know, when you see his kind of physical profile, if that's improving, man, I really like what they've done here in terms of getting him on the board early.
So yeah, I can't remember which site has him listed at what height, but I think 247 I think has him at like 6 foot. Yeah, and even on their site he's ranked 167. Is that right?
Yeah, in the composite.
And that feels like, I mean, it feels like when you watch him play and you see him compete even like against Oak Hill, which, you know, is loaded with 4- and 5-star players. You have to think that if he were 6'2", 6'3", possibly 6'4", that's a guy that's a top 100 player. You know, then the conversation around picking up a guy like that is,
you've got a cornerstone for your class, or in a 4-man class, that's a guy you want to hit. You want to start off with.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting to me because like one of the things I feel is often overlooked is individual development. When you talk about all these guys develop at different ages, you know, and not just with their game, but physically, like if you watch, you know, David Joplin, and he's another guy that picked up a Mizzou offer and looks like, you know, Mizzou is in a position where they could, you know, really make a serious run at him. Initially, a lot of people will probably see a guy like that and see him kind of unranked, you know, unranked 3-star. Okay, now what are we really going for here? But then you watch the tape of the guy and you see a guy who from 1 year to the next year just looked like a completely different player. You watch him from the summer and then you watch him in his high school tape and he just looks physically stronger.
Bigger through the shoulders, filled out chest-wise.
More, just looks more athletic.
I mean, watch him off 1 foot. His 1 foot jump is, there's some bounce there now.
Yeah. So I think that's one of those things. It's tough because, you know, maybe Brookshire does get to be 6'4". Maybe he doesn't hit 6'4" until he's, you know, a freshman in college. Maybe it's a sophomore in college. But what is it that you're buying at this point of the program? You're buying a guy with a proven ability to make shots. And he does it in a lot of different levels. I imagine...
A lot of different ways.
I imagine that he may have some issues finishing around the rim initially, mainly because he's not explosively athletic. He's a little bit more crafty, a little more smooth. But he is a guy that I think you watch him with his body control now, and you can see him developing into a guy that will become a really good finisher around the rim, even if he doesn't have that really elite athleticism. I think he probably, I don't really think you're going to compare him to Drew Smith, but I think Drew Smith is kind of a similar guy in that he's not overwhelmingly athletic, but he knows how to use his body. He knows how to create space around the rim, and he knows how to finish. And so I think what you're doing with Brookshire is you're buying a guy who has the potential to develop into the kind of talent that you can really build a lot of things around. And really, there's nothing that this roster needs more than just a dude who can make shots. And one of my favorite things of watching all the tape, and this includes, you know, plenty of game tape, and a lot of games that I think two or three, maybe four games you can watch that are at the JQH in Springfield, where there's the college 3-point line actually on the floor. And he's
hitting from 2 to 3 feet. Yeah. 2 to 3 feet behind.
He's comfortable shooting from deep. And, you know, for a team that has really struggled to shoot the ball in a lot of ways, you know, having a guy that as a freshman could at least do that, I think would be a big help.
Yeah, I think the one thing that impresses me is, you know, if you have to kind of hunt and dig for it, it's on the Ozark Independent site, which is kind of an independent outlet in Southwest Missouri. They have the entire game tape of Kickapoo versus Greenwood Lab School, which if you're following us and you're listening to us, you know that that's Aminu Muhammad's school. And so in their game, Muhammad just went bonkers. I think he scored 49 out of Greenwood Lab 65. He was their offense. So you're going to like just get caught watching him. But if you watch...
He's physically impressive. He can't shoot outside to save his life. I mean, it's anybody's guess.
But when he gets
guess.
Going north-south...
Like when he pulls God up from three, you. It's like it's anybody's guess where it's going to end up. But you get him inside 15 feet and he's a terror.
I mean, God help those kids in 2-way. I watched them play my dad's alma mater, my high school alma mater, Orion, a couple of years ago, and my dad was watching 2-way and he texted me. He goes, just praying for the boys right now. Just, he goes, they're slow rotating to help side already against that kid who they're never going to see ever again in the boot heel. Yeah, that kid needs to go play at like a 5A school in some state. But if you watch Brookshire in that game, dude scored 22 points, I think, off something like 9 for 11 shooting. Like, an easy 22. I think he canned like 3 of... I think he canned 3 of 5 threes in that ballgame. And, like, one is off a ball screen where a guy goes under, which was a mistake. One is where he rejects a ball screen, attacks the outside foot of the defender, gets him off balance, brings the ball back, hits a jumper. And the other one was a catch and shoot. There are some where he's working off the ball. I think the one thing I like that Springfield Kickapoo does is they put their big kind of in the pinch post and they have him kind of operate as a passer and have guards play off of him. So you'll see Brookshire come off double staggers on a wing. You'll see him kind of flare. You'll see him run AI cuts for him. Basically, you'll see him do a lot of stuff off the ball and play off a big in a different spot on the floor and free himself. He's got a good sense of when to cut off the ball. There's just a lot of stuff that I enjoy. Like, a lot of his highlight tapes are him handling, but if you watch that game tape, to watch him move off the ball is really impressive. I think that that's something sometimes you don't see from a lot of guys that age, is just the ability to understand how to work and how to move constantly and what they want to do and move with a purpose. You know, he's not just drifting around the floor. When he's cutting with purpose. He's trying to get to a spot. He's trying to create space. He's trying to create separation. I think that's one thing, like you talked about earlier, is if a guy's already been kind of taught to do that and has that sort of ability already, you'll bet on that. You'll hope that, you know, if he is 6'2", that size helps him, and you'll hope that he'll get a little bit stronger. The one thing I think he does have going for him well is he already has kind of a nice little nifty floater inside of 10 feet that he uses. He can get it off over bigger defenders. He did that a couple times on tape. So I think what you and I are probably saying, if we had to distill it down, is he's just got a ton of skill. And if there's one thing you want to bet on that. And, you know, that's why you pay a strength and conditioning coach. That's why you have training tables. That's why he comes to a college program. But if he's already got a lot of skill coming through the door, that's a great place to start.
So I'm pretty happy with this addition. And I do think that if there is any kind of lag period at all, there's a real possibility that he moves up. But if he doesn't, I am still going to bet on the kind of talent that he has. Joplin, we already kind of discussed. That offer went out, and I think...
same night.
Yeah, same night. So it was like... he was offered by Joplin Butler
that day, and then...
was it the same day?
Mizzou got to him. Yeah, he was offered that morning. Mizzou got to him in early evening. UNLV's offered... I think it's just a matter of when Marquette and Iowa State pull the trigger. At least that's what I was told last week. That's another guy where, like you said, you watch the tape over a couple of years and you can just see a role for him right away. I think I told somebody that he reminds me a little bit of Bryce Hopkins, who Missouri tried to recruit last year.
Yeah.
He shut that down pretty quickly and committed to Louisville, and then his stock just blew up. But it blew up because Hopkins had a similar build. Sturdily built, strong, physically mature, but he still had a little bit of extra weight on him, but he slimmed down. And once that happened, just his lateral agility and his ability to kind of play off the bounce got better, and he just shot up the rankings. You watch Joplin, and I think you kind of alluded to it, already has a little bounce to him. He's already athletic. The one thing I like about him is he's got a natural shot. Shoots a little bit of a toe-raise jumper, but he doesn't have to explode into it. But his shot mechanics look good.
I mean, when you're 6'7", also.
You don't need to elevate that much.
I mean, Jordan Barnett kind of did the same thing, so.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, that's just me watching. That's the one thing that stands out. I'm not saying it's obviously not a deal-breaker.
Right.
But that's a guy that if you can, again, it's just like anything. You get him into a good strength and conditioning program. Suddenly, you know, you unlock something there for him. And you unlock his physical potential. But the one thing I like is that he's a guy who can already sort of hit spot-up jumpers. But if you watch him on tape, and I think I tweeted this out, he's got really good footwork operating on the low block and working and creating space for kind of, you know, step-backs and little kind of mid-range jumpers there. And he hits those pretty consistently, which I like because that becomes a guy who now you can, you know, have him down screen and then, you know, get a favorable switch and bury a guard in the post, and he can operate there and get and create a shot. He's a guy who in the open floor runs to a spot and can hit shot. It's in the corner. He can run the wing on the break and attack the rim. If he's got a spot up ability, you can pick and pop him, or you can just space him to a wing. You know, even if you don't need him to be a guy who puts a ball on the deck early, he's a guy whose shooting ability and just his ability to exploit mismatches can give him a role. And so I think that's another guy where you watch him and you think, oh, he's not in the top 150 right now, but there's some skill sets that I think can translate. And if he were out on the circuit right now, you know, given what colleges are pursuing him, I think you'd see him, you know, make some headway in the ranking. So this might be a case where, again, the staff might, you know, have been, you know, solid in trying to get in early and buy some stock.
And it does look like they've at least made an early impression. I mean, he's been pretty receptive to Mizzou already. And I think that that's one of those situations where if, and I kind of feel, I think you kind of alluded to something similar, that if you're getting in on a kind of combo forward that a school like Butler is interested in, then you're probably doing okay, because their history with that position has been pretty solid. And I think Joplin is a guy that would fit in really well at Butler. I think he would fit in really well at Missouri. And hopefully the Tigers can kind of maintain, I guess, their interest and be able to get him in the fold. I think that even though the rankings aren't super high on guys like, you know, Brookshire and Joplin, if you have those two within your class, I think you have guys that are going to be really big difference makers, for a long period of time.
And I think we can, this sort of leads us into what kind of the bigger picture about what this class is, because they're going to need to fill spots. They could have five, six, seven slots they've got to fill next year. And I get tweeted at that, Konzo needs a big haul this year. And my sort of thought is that's just not going to happen. There's not going to be a monster class with three top 50 guys in it. It's just not the way, the in-state crop is not particularly top heavy this year as it has been the past couple of years. So you're not going to have guys like Caleb Lover, Cam Fletcher, or even like an EJ Liddell or Courtney Ramey. There's not like a bona fide top 50 kid, at least right now, in the region. And if you're trying to get into Michigan right now, Pierre Brooks has already come off the board. Julian Roper liked Missouri. I think Missouri would have been a factor had he been able to get to campus. That just wasn't in the cards. He commits to Northwestern, I think a couple weeks ago, or last week he committed to Northwestern. So now two guys are off the board, and, two wings are off the board. And now you're down to Kobe Bufkin, Jaden Akins in that state, and, prying them out is going to be hard. I think it's going to be tough to pull them, especially, if Michigan State wants either of them. If, Michigan State wants Akins right now, that's going to happen. I think if Bufkin gets prioritized by Juwan Howard, I think that's going to be a tough pull. So there's not like ready-made solutions or home runs in this class. We'll see what Tamar Bates, what they can do with Tamar Bates. We can talk about him and his situation in a bit. But the point here is I think you're going to need to find guys like Brookshire or Joplin, or even a guy like Yaya Keita, who, man, that guy is raw, but he has an insane motor. He is physically built, and he will get on the glass. He will, give you a physical presence. He's a guy you can stick in the short corner, and you're going to hope that you can flesh out his skill level when he gets to campus. But I think the overall objective right now is less on finding home runs than it should be on what we've talked about, which are finding guys that, have some defined skill sets that you can, flow them into some roles and really flesh them out and develop them. I think that's where they're going to have to be. And maybe when they go into next spring, they're going to have to try and maybe find some instant impact guys on the transfer market. That's just sort of where I start when I assess this class and kind of the trajectory it's on in May.
So you kind of talked on Akins and Bufkin, and I think of the two there, Bufkin is probably a little more likely.
Reachable. He's a little bit more gettable.
And mainly because from all intel, it seems like Akins has been prioritized by Michigan State. And that's always going to be tough to talk a Michigan kid out of a Michigan or Michigan State offer when they're a priority. And I think that the hope with Bufkin is more that Michigan State and Michigan have both prioritized other guys. And we are seeing some evidence of that right now. Both of those schools tend to swim in deeper waters when it comes to recruits, because they do have the ability to reach nationally. So if there are guys in that sort of point guard, combo guard position, I think if Michigan State were given a choice between Akins and Bufkin, and I think ultimately that's probably what it's going to come down to, they would probably take Akins. If Michigan is looking then at Bufkin or, you know, another player who's maybe say from Florida or you know Illinois or Ohio or something, they might be more willing to talk Bufkin into waiting to see what happens with that other player first, which when that happens, that tends to kind of push the guys that are a lower priority for the home school into the hands of another school. And I think that's where a situation where a school like Missouri could really kind of pounce and jump in and show Bufkin that he is a priority for them. I think the foundation, if you can get a guy like Yaya Keita and then complement him with a guy like David Joplin, the goal then should be adding one more
top-end piece.
Probably like a combo guard level player who can step in and play right away. And to me, the two clear-cut guys that sort of fit that role that I think are gettable for Missouri are Bufkin and Tamar Bates. Obviously, you know, Bates with the Kansas interest is tough because I think a lot of people assume that
he's a lock.
Yeah, he's a lock for Kansas, but I tend to think that my read on the situation is that the family and Tamar are being smart about this, and they understand that the kind of class that Kansas puts together on a regular basis tend to be pretty good. And the possibility exists that he could sign on and get over-recruited.
Or if Kansas gets smacked coming out of this NOA with all kinds of fun postseason bans and other restrictions, suddenly you're not committing to full strength Kansas or you're committing to, I'm trying to think, probation Kansas. It's a little bit, there's uncertainty either way there. And I think the one thing that will be interesting is what the move to IMG Academy, which he announced he'll be doing that for his senior year, what that does for his recruitment. They've been on a trajectory to decide at the end of the summer, which would mean that he would not play, which would mean that he would decide probably before IMG goes out on the prep circuit. And IMG is, you know, a team that plays in big time national showcases. They play a national schedule. They have plenty of attention and eyes on him. If you're making that move and looking to up your offers, maybe you back it up to a spring commitment. You go through a year with IMG, you see what kind of interest you garner. But that comes with the downside risk of other schools are going to potentially fill their classes up. And if you don't hit, if you don't have the kind of year you anticipate, now you're kind of scrambling a little bit, or you could see your options winnowed. So what happens with Bates will be interesting. You know, as we learned today, the dead period is going to go through June. So Missouri and other schools can't host a guy like Bates on campus. That just can't happen. They can do Zoom visits. They can do whatever other virtual interaction they want. But the real question will be to me with a guy like Bates is, do we have a July period? Is he able to get out with KC Run GMC, play some Under Armour Association events, you know, put on display what, you know, he showcased during a prep season where he bulked up, he was stronger, he was playing more on the ball. He is really, you know, he's gotten a little bouncier as he's matured. He's always been a tough finisher and a tough player, but that's even bigger now. Now he's playing a little bit more downhill, not just a pure spot-up guy anymore, showcasing some passing. If that shows up on the Under Armour circuit and you know, if we have one in July, then I think his stock goes up and we could see what happened with Caleb Love, where, you know, Caleb, you know, had a huge jump, you know, in the summer period before his senior year and kind of played his way out of the, you know, the typical range of the recruiting rankings that Missouri might find some success. So Bates moving forward is going to be interesting to monitor. One, like I said, is there any chance for a July blow up to happen? And if there's no July period, does he decide to continue with a timeline to commit in the fall? Or does he back that up and, you know, play with IMG through a prep year and see what happens? So all that's uncertain right now, but I think that's one thing to monitor with him is, you know, when, you know, what does the timeline look like for him? Because I think he's a guy, if, you know, he keeps the list pretty tight right now, I think you feel good about where Missouri is and you know, nothing's ever certain, but I think you feel good about the position they've put themselves in to maybe find some success there.
Yeah, I mean, if I think if I had my druthers, I think a class of, you know, Bates and Brookshire and Joplin and Kaida would really kind of get me excited.
You filled spots created by the departures of Mark Smith and Drew Smith. You fill Mitchell Smith's spot at combo forward, and you get a high ceiling guy there. And Kate is a guy who I think you can flex between the four and five in different lineups. And, you know, that's a good bet on him. And then I think you go into the transfer market. You know, I'm not sure if you'd want to hunt for a post and a wing on the transfer market. You know, obviously we have no clue what can happen a year from now, but I think that's kind of what I would want to see happen is you fill two combo guard spots, a combo forward, a flex post player, and then you kind of go find a wing in another post in the transfer market.
Yeah, I think we have no idea whatsoever of what to expect from Jordan Wilmore. So I have to think if Wilmore hits campus and is like, you know, gangbusters in the post, then I think you feel pretty good about him going into his sophomore year, but I don't think either of us really expect that. You know, so if he is more of a reserve guy, just you're going to need to find some more somebody who can kind of score in and around the basket and be kind of a threat, you know, down low. I'm not a, you know, guy who's going to be out here saying you need a guy who's going to, you know, put his butt on the block and post up for 35 minutes a game.
I'd like to find a mobile big.
But, I mean, but you do want somebody who can finish around the rim. You do want somebody who can, you know, work within the framework of the offense and, you know, be good on pick and rolls and, you know, and when there's a drive, find a way to, you know, get to the dunker spot and, you know, and either catch lobs or dump offs and be able to kind of finish those kinds of plays. 'Cause, you know, particularly in the SEC with so many athletic big men, who are so willing to try to meet you at the rim. Missouri hasn't really been blessed. I mean, Tillman's pretty good at it. But I think that's one of the areas where Mitchell Smith really struggles. I think, you know, Nico, his size and his you know, broad shoulders kind of helps a little bit, but, you know, he still would get blocked by wings. So I think that's probably what you're kind of hoping to find. But at this point, I think you're looking at probably a 3-4 man class. And then mainly because I think they're going to set up the one-time transfer rule to be a go. And next spring, it's going to be a free-for-all for transfers. There's probably going to be a lot of guys that get approved for, you know, a play right away waiver. But next year, I think they're going to have that rule in place. You can transfer one time with no penalty. And I think what you're going to see then is you're going to see a lot of guys on the move. My thought is that what you do is because Missouri So let's say, you know, best case scenario, Missouri has a really good season. You know, they're graduating a bunch of players. You know, maybe, you know, Torrance Watson is able to kind of figure something out and get back to kind of the guy that we thought or we hoped we were getting when he committed. And then you have a really good recruiting class. You have this four-man recruiting class, you know, the guys that we just talked about. Well, now you have this, like, framework of a team that could be pretty good, but they're still kind of missing, you know, one piece. And they're coming off a season where, you know, they were maybe in the NCAA tournament, and even though they were a lower seed, there's still an opportunity for guys to kind of come in and be a, you know, difference maker and step in right away. So I think that that becomes an attractive position for, you know, a wing scorer, a guy who can get buckets on the wing, and then maybe somebody, you know, who you can fit in around the basket. And that's kind of the approach that I think would work. And I also think that there's a strong possibility that if, you know, Pinson has a good year going into next year, that he bounces no matter what his draft stock is.
Yeah. The one thing, I think the hardest part about this too is, you know, we've talked about, you have six freshmen. And you take a six-man class of freshmen, that doesn't solve your roster balancing. The one thing about taking two transfers is you can try and do some roster smoothing and get some balance back across classes again, so you're not in a spot where you're having to just do this every year. This is kind of a, you know, if there had not been exits by McKinney and Jackson, I think this would have looked like a maybe a little bigger than expected class, but, you know, those two defections have sort of put them in a bind where there's just going to be a lot of churn. So I think you've got to try and also find a way to not just, yeah, I think it solves short-term needs, which we've talked about here on the transfer market, but also try and ensure that you have a little bit of balance moving forward. So that's the other thing that can be achieved by going into the transfer market next spring.
Yeah. So if you have, Bates and Brookshire, and even if Pinson comes back, you're still probably going to need one more guy who can handle the ball. And then you would have Pickett, Watson, Kobe Brown, Ed Chang, no idea what he's going to provide, Parker Brown, and Jordan Wilmore. And like it's kind of like I said, we don't really know what we're going to get from Jordan Wilmore, so you probably want to have one more post. You get a guy at combo forward. After watching Kobe Brown for a year, I think I actually kind of like him more as a wing than I do at that combo forward spot. I'd like to...
if you get Joplin or Joplin-Katie, you can bump him to a wing spot. So maybe that solves your need for the wing.
Yeah, you know, I think if you had, like, Pinson, and then what you would probably do is have, like, Pinson and Brown and, you know, maybe Bates at your combo guard spot, and then you can kind of fit around maybe another freshman or an upperclassman, you know, transfer on the combo forward and the post. But I think at that point you're starting to kind of form a roster that you can make another run at an NCAA tournament, and now you're starting to kind of build classes again. And I think that that's one of the things that when Konzo Martin kind of lost a few of the recruiting battles that I think they were really, really hoping to win early on, they ended up kind of making some concessions with some guys in transfers, and now they're at a point where their roster management is a little bit of a mismatch. And it is what it is at this point. Like, I think that if you are able to kind of put together this season and have a good year, have a good freshman class, you know, coming in, then you're kind of back on the right track. But they really, at some point, need to kind of fill in these two middle classes. As of right now, the 2021 roster consists of two juniors, a sophomore, and a freshman.
You got to get old and stay old, man.
Yeah, like that's the ultimate idea, right? Is that you have a progression of classes, and so like you want to be able to kind of have guys with experience coming back on a regular basis. And I think the idea of just having nothing but like these 4-year guys is, I mean, it's probably never going to be like that again, but you still have to find a way to kind of balance those classes. So you do have returning people coming back. You do have more talented guys. And then, you know, maybe by then we had name, image, and likeness laws in place, and we can actually start getting some of these guys to, you know, get some money and stay in school a little longer.
It'll be interesting to see what the season looks like, and we'll talk about this closer to the season whenever it takes place. The schedule is not exactly shaping up. I mean, I love the schedule so far, but...
Well, it's a tough schedule, but it's also, like, the benefit of the schedule is that realistically, you could be, like, 17-14 at the end of the year and still make the NCAA tournament because your schedule is so good.
Yeah, you'll get the committee. This is one of those deals where the NCAA selection committee said, we want to see teams take on quality road and neutral site games. Well, Missouri is going to achieve that objective. Going to Wichita State, neutral versus Kansas, neutral versus Illinois. 3 neutral site games where they could play improved Pitt, improved Nebraska, Dayton, Loyola Chicago, Utah State. 3 really, really good mid-majors. I mean, it's... Oh, and they got the Big 12 SEC Challenge mixed in there, too. Which maybe that will be a home game. Maybe... Oh, and Utah. They got Utah. I mean, the... Be prepared, folks, to see the other 4 or 5 home games be a little bit lighter fare, we'll call it that. Like, I don't want to see Missouri fans griping about how the other 4 home games are obviously bye games. That's what's needed given what they've taken on here. They could potentially have 7 or 8 top 100 opponents in the non-con alone. It's and not all of them at, and only maybe 2 of those games will be in Columbia.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing sort of looming here too is, you know, if they've got to put together, you know, if the idea for Martin to inject stability is to, one, put together a recruiting class that stabilizes those, you know, the middle classes that we've talked about, and also put together a quality on-court product, you know, he's facing some challenges. I think that's just the point I want to get to is the recruiting calendar's absolutely been torpedoed here. That creates challenges in terms of putting together a class. And because of what's happened, you know, to potentially with athletic budgets and having to go to more regional-based scheduling, Missouri's taken on a really tough non-conference schedule, and they could, you know, we'll have to see what the Birmingham office does, but the SEC slate could be really daunting. So he may, you know, we've talked before about how Konzo needs to catch some breaks. The schedule could be really daunting this year, and in a year where he, and in a class where he needs to really put together something of substance and durability, the recruiting calendar is absolutely shot to hell. So, you know, we're pleased to see the Brookshire commitment, and I think that's why that news is so welcome, because that's a guy that and a pickup that you want to see that can, that's the kind of pickup this class is going to need, and it's the kind of news that the program needs right now. We'll see if they can build off it, because moving forward, there's going to be some built-in challenges that are going to test the capability of the program and of the staff.
And, you know, we joke a lot offline about Zoe and his luck since he's been at Missouri. Maybe he's just been saving it all up for this upcoming year, because it has not he has not been the luckiest coach in NCAA. There's been some brutal injuries, you know, really poor timing, things that just do not seem to go Missouri's way. And now, in a class where he needs to be out there hustling on the recruiting trail, the NCAA is basically saying, "Nah, you can't do that."
And I think you joked about it a couple weeks ago. This could be a year where they go 7-6 and 8-5 in non-con and legitimately be better than they were a year ago. It's just,
yeah. I think it's realistic that this team ends up, you know, because like we talked about it last year, like if they get things to kind of go their way, and really if all everybody played all year, Missouri was kind of playing like around a top 50 team by the time Tillman went down. Obviously things weren't really trending great. They had a horrible loss with Tillman, you know, but they were still playing at a level you feel like things would have been okay. I think with, you know, another year and just with a little bit of luck, this team can still be the kind of team that we thought they could be last year, which is like a top, you know, top 40, level team. And it's very possible that they are like, and 40 in KenPom, we'll say, you know, 45th in KenPom, and be 500 in non-conference play. Like, that's the kind of conference schedule or non-conference schedule that they're playing. And it's, I mean, if they're 7-6, everyone's going to be like grumbling and ready to fire Martin. And it's going to be like, man, they've got like losses to Kansas.
Illinois.
It's just like I realize that, yeah, Kansas, Illinois, you know, Wichita State on the road. They had a close win over Missouri State on the road. It's just like, geez, like, can we get this man some luck? I just, let's all put in, you know, Zoe gets lucky this year, things go his way, and those, some of those close losses become close wins, and Missouri finds their way back in the NCAA tournament. That's all I'm hoping for, man. It's just a little bit of change in luck.
I mean, I like the schedule. I know there are going to be people who dislike going to play at Missouri State, and I have heard you, and I understand all the reasons why there's some opposition to it. You know, even down to the fact that, you know, there are fights in the state legislature over funding levels and, you know, kind of the, you know, the support that Missouri State's given versus Missouri. There's all that kind of stuff that happens. To me, it's just an interesting game, man. I would rather Missouri, you know, take a road trip to SMS than play Chicago State at home. I would rather them go play SLU than have a dead atmosphere against Morehead State the second week of December. I would rather them go play Wichita State on the road, even if that's tough, than, you know, have Northern Kentucky at home. I just think that those are games that if you're a fan of the sport in general and writ large, you want to see. Those are the matchups you want to see. And, you know, when you look at those teams on paper right now, Wichita State may not be the kind of Wichita State people expect. They had, I think, 6 scholarship guys leave and go into the transfer portal. Missouri State lost 3 seniors and had 3 guys transfer. You know, so those are going to be tough games, you know, just given, you know, what we saw from Missouri this year and, you know, hoping that they improve. But those games, I think you have to keep in mind, too, the other team changes as well. But I'm glad that we get to see those two, you know, those matchups, you know, as opposed to, you know, just a bye game and, you know, an arena where, you know, maybe is 40% of the seats are filled. So that's my rant that I wanted to squeeze in at the end is I get the argument about optics and sometimes against, you know, going to SLU or SMS, but man, I'll take that over a crappy bye game any day of the week.
Yeah, and I think if there is a sort of benefit to some of the, I guess, budget challenges that a lot of schools are going to face with the, you know, the economic impact of COVID, is I do think you're going to see a lot of what we've kind of been clamoring about for a couple of years now in this podcast is more regional scheduling in the non-conference, which will make college basketball vastly more interesting. So maybe you don't care about watching, like, I don't know, Furman versus UConn or something.
Well, I would love that game, but I'm weird.
But right, but it's like regionally, I think you're going to see more games where, you know, teams that are closer to each other are going to be more likely to play. I think when you see that at like I think it's great that North Carolina in the last few years has willingly gone to places Wofford and they went to another place. Was it Asheville or Greensboro? But they did another it was another state school. And they went on the road and played that game. I would much rather see games like that, you know, than, I mean, like I really never want to see North Florida
ever again
at Mizzou Arena. I never want to see even though the game ended up being fun, like the Stephen F. Austin game. And even though I have a lot of respect for that program and what they've done the last few years, I don't care about Missouri playing Stephen F. Austin. You know who should play Stephen F. Austin is Texas A&M, Texas, LSU. These are the regional games that I think would be far more interesting than paying for a team to fly up, to Columbia from, who knows where.
This will be the slate that you could possibly see: Wichita State, Kansas, Illinois, Missouri State. They could see Nebraska at the Myrtle Beach game. And let's say they get Oklahoma State in the SEC Big 12 Challenge. That's a great slate regionally. That is fantastic. Because you're going to – and Kansas, Illinois, Missouri State, and let's say the Big 12 SEC game is in Columbia and Oklahoma State. Those could all be within 2 hours of Columbia or in Columbia. That's phenomenal. That's a phenomenal, phenomenal slate. Your fan bases – and your alumni in St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield get games. You know, the Wichita State game is certainly interesting. It's just interesting in totality. And it's going to be salty, and it's going to be a tough schedule, but I'm going to enjoy watching those games. I'm going to enjoy seeing those matchups. And I hope that, folks can at least appreciate it from that perspective.
I'm with you. So, you're working on a couple pieces.
Yeah, I'm piddling away on a piece that kind of takes a deeper look at Missouri's pace and how it plays and sort of what goes into that. I think that's really interesting. And sort of what tweaks could happen or they could take to play faster. I'm hopefully going to have that early next week, and I'm picking away at kind of an SEC. Appraisal and kind of just where the conference stands right now. Now that we have guys who've declared for the draft, and hopefully I'll start getting to do some recruit profiles and stuff like that. That's also on the horizon if I can get these other two pieces checked off.
I'm not working on anything other than trying to get these last what ifs published. I hope people have been enjoying those. I've actually enjoyed kind of going back and reviewing some of the stuff that that Bill did, because Bill, has always kind of done these what if posts. So it's interesting that SB Nation decided to kind of do it this week. So it's allowed me to kind of revisit some of the stuff that he used to do. So we've got a couple more coming those this week, and last thing I was gonna cocktail of the week, Matt, you. Have a cocktail of the week you want to talk about?
Not really. We don't do the curbside pickup for cocktails, and I have sort of been telling myself what I want to do is wait until we can have outdoor seating again so I can go with Ellery to an outdoor restaurant socially distanced away from people. And there's a place that we really like in Indianapolis called Thunderbird that does a whole bunch of really good stuff, and they have a great patio, and go sit there, order a drink, and sort of try to decompress. Indianapolis is targeting May 22, assuming the epidemiology forecast holds. So I have not had a cocktail lately. It's just been bourbon straight up and with a little bit of ice. But I am pointed to May 22 for a cocktail here.
So I'm going to
assault Stanley Tucci again.
No, I'm going to talk about a black Manhattan. So I think a lot of people are probably familiar with a Manhattan, which is traditionally two parts bourbon or rye whiskey, an ounce of one part of sweet vermouth, and then a few dashes of bitters, finish off with a cherry or a twist of lemon, depending on your preference. But a black Manhattan is when instead of a sweet vermouth that you actually use an Amaro. And Amaro is a lot like vermouth. It's a similar alcohol by volume. It tends to be a little more floral at times, and it usually has like one thing that they sort of use as their main base. One of my favorite substitutions in a black Manhattan is actually to use something called Chinar. It's C-Y-N-A-R. It is an artichoke-based Amaro, a liqueur. And so it's called black Manhattan. The Amaro tends to turn the Manhattan a little darker than than a regular Manhattan. And then add in your bitters. So my recommendation, 2 ounces of rye whiskey, 1 ounce of Chinar, a twist of lemon to stir in. And it is a really, really nice cocktail, very earthy, but it can complement all the way kind of into the summer if you like kind of fun things in the summer. So hit me up on Twitter if you want more info on Black Manhattans. You can follow me at Sam T. Snelling. Matt is on Twitter also. I don't know what his Twitter profile is. It's mostly trash. So
this is true. This is true.
Matt J. Harris 85. That's it, right?
That's it.
Any and all complaints about this trash podcast go to Mitch Hill, who's already sending me messages about whether or not we're done. So yes, Mitch, we are done.
We're
wrapping this up. Go subscribe to the podcast, and I think the guys from Before the Box Score will be back next week. So until then, thanks for tuning in, and stay healthy, everybody.